the ridiculous to the sublime. Just before we get started with the plenary session itself, it's my pleasure to introduce to you, for a few words, the very first combined archivist and national librarian for Canada, Dr. Ian Wilson.
Thank you very much. That was brief. Bonjour tout le monde. C'est pour moi vraiment un grand plaisir d'être ici avec vous, parmi vous, une fois de plus. Some of you will remember I had some involvement with public libraries in Ontario when I was working with the Ontario government. We did some great things together. I remember developing the report, One Place to Look. I remember implementing that report and maintaining it through a number of years in the early 90s and maintaining that vision. What we're trying to do with the Library and Archives, Canada's newest national cultural institution, also Canada's oldest national cultural institution, based on and carrying forward the work of the National Archives, established in 1872, and the work of the National Library, established in 1953, but looking to try to carry forward their traditions, their expertise, their professionalism, to carry forward their extraordinary collections, and now to make these collections available and accessible to Canadians from coast to coast to coast. That's our real mandate. That's why the Government of Canada, as a key strategic initiative for the 21st century, decided to create a new kind of knowledge institution, one that brings together the professions of librarians and archivists and other information disciplines to serve Canadians and to ensure that these extraordinary collections we've gathered are properly preserved, properly cared for. That's key. It's part of our stewardship. But also to make sure, increasingly, as we get on the web, as we use and work with reference librarians across the country, as we work with archives in all corners of this country, to ensure that these collections are known and become an active part of the lives of Canadians as they search for information and knowledge about this country. Now, we just came from a session where I spoke at some considerable length about the Library and Archives, what we're doing, how we're implementing. There's more information, the organizations coming together, the structures coming together, the integration of reference services and our national services are coming together. There's a lot of work to be done. It's a work in progress. And I concluded my remarks earlier this morning by quoting from Dr. Kay Lam, who was really the first to hold the joint position in the 1950s and 60s. He was Dominion archivist and national librarian. And Kay Lam, in 1947, in his inaugural address as incoming president of the new-founded Canadian Library Association, talked about this mandate for the future. And he finished by quoting George Bernard Shaw, whom he had heard speak to the Fabian Society in London a couple of years earlier. And he said that Shaw had said, "You get all steamed up about a problem and all excited about a grievance, and you go and hear someone expound that topic and discuss the matter thoroughly, and you agree heartily. And you go home under the totally false impression that you have done something about it." Dr. Lam had outlined a marvelous vision for both the public archives and the National Library. And he concluded by saying, "Now that is just a left-handed way, ladies and gentlemen, of saying to you that this mandate for the Library and Archives that I have spoken about is not my mandate. It is our mandate for the future. We look forward to working with all of you right across this province and across the country in the years ahead." Thank you. Merci bien.
Session if you were here. and it was absolutely wonderful. We heard Craig Kyleberg, and I tell you, it touched my heart, it touched my soul. What we heard was passion and an inspirational message of hope and belief. And I think that what we heard from in many ways was the most articulate young man in Canada, and a young man that made me exceptionally proud to be a Canadian. Today, in almost a bookend of that conversation, as far as I'm concerned, we are hearing from the most articulate man in Canada, who shares that same passion, who has that same ability to touch your soul, an ability to tell stories, and to absolutely make sure that the message that he sends is one that absolutely hits every one of us enormously, I don't know, just as deep as it can possibly be. And I'm exceptionally proud that on this stage during the OLA conference, a number of my heroes have been up here. Craig Kyleberger, in just a few minutes, Stephen Lewis, and my son, who thanked Craig Kyleberger yesterday at the end of his address. They are all heroes in my life, and they will be up here. And I would like to give to you a person I'm exceptionally proud to introduce to you as being, well, when he was a politician, I adored him. I would listen to him, and it was some of the few political speeches that I would actually take care and listen to, because he was actually speaking to the issues and speaking to the heart. But I think he really found his beat and found his pace after he left, and Craig Kyleberger would say found his gift after he left politics and became the United Nations Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa. The message that he has managed to present to Canadians and to the world has been one of enormous importance to all of us. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give to you a man that I believe to be one of the absolutely greatest Canadians and the most articulate man in Canada, Stephen Lewis.
Thank you, everyone. That was an inordinately gracious and, in the most generous, if unseemly way, hyperbolic an introduction, and it leaves me both appreciative and quaking at the expectations which have been aroused in this audience. I had to smile gently to myself at Ken's suggestion that he had adored me as a politician, because in truth, my political life was one of the most astonishing exercises in transcendental futility that anyone could wish to embrace. And my ascendance to legitimacy came only with the excursion to the United Nations in the middle of the 1980s, which excursion was facilitated by, I remind you gently, Brian Mulroney. And I remind you of Brian Mulroney because I am the only person you will ever meet who is indebted to Brian Mulroney. And for those of you who are immediately anxious that I will resort to the maniacal spasms of the left, to which I'm naturally addicted, I want to calm you all down and tell you that I am now a mortal of entirely moderate mien. I inherited that from having worked for the Tories for 4 years between 1984 and 1988. As a matter of fact, when you work for the Conservatives for 4 years, you're not only cleansed, you're positively neutered. And I can now entertain a degree of self-discipline with verges on the supernatural. I was delighted to receive the letter from your executive director, Larry Moore, confirming the invitation to this auspicious gathering. He said in his note that the last time I had appeared before the Ontario Library Association was back in the late 1980s, and it occurred to me that that simply shows how much time has to elapse before I'm invited back. And even then, the invitation, when you think of it, was entirely accidental, bogus, and fraudulent. I am here to replace Alan Gregg. I am not here on my own legitimacy. And it is a rather good thing, therefore, that I regard Alan Gregg as one of the most knowledgeable social and political commentators in this country, and I'm more than happy to fill in. So I am here largely without credentials, save one. And the one credential is, in fact, my wife, Michelle Landsberg, who will be known to numbers of you. Michelle, as many of you will know, retired only recently after 20 to 25 years as a passionate, knowledgeable, articulate, gifted, left-wing, socialist, feminist columnist in the Toronto Star. And I have had the extraordinary privilege all of my adult life, yea, unto 41 years now, of being able to phone home at any hour of the day or night and say, honey, what do I believe about so-and-so? And I will always be told, in no uncertain terms, and then I can come to gatherings like this and disgorge views which you mistakenly think are my own. One of the truths about Michelle, of course, is that she has been wedded to children's literature all of her life, has written and commented on children's literature extensively all of her life, and has created for me and for our children a love of reading, and therefore of libraries, and therefore by organic extension, a love of librarians, which lasts deeply to this day. As a matter of fact, in one of those rare eccentric moments in life, I spent a great deal of time towards the end of my so-called political career and afterwards wandering the province of Ontario actually reading stories to teachers. I don't think I've ever enjoyed anything more, and it was an absolutely wondrous antidote to the necessity of speechifying in the more normal fashion. I don't want to pretend to any expertise on the subject matter of the general range of the activities of librarians and librarians. That you will be relieved to know won't prevent me from speaking. I learned a long time ago never to allow an absence of knowledge to impede opinion. And since I share that with the political leadership of this country, I certainly won't feel self-conscious about saying what I came to say. But I do have to say that matters of the internet and matters of reading, which for me are largely now confined to airplanes, are not as intense as I wish they were. And when I read your program, I'm absolutely overwhelmed. I have rarely seen a program so extensive, so ranging, so fascinating. I gave it to Michelle this morning. She looked through it and looked up to me and said, "This is dazzling." And it is. It's positively encyclopedic. And therefore, it is also somewhat intimidating and daunting. And you cannot imagine how much better I felt and how much more at home I felt when I picked up the most recent edition of your magazine, Access, and saw a copy of the Communist Manifesto on the cover. It becalmed my levitating heart. And it spoke, of course, to questions of censorship, raising from Galileo to Darwin to Marx to numbers of contemporary writers, and the way in which librarians deal with these issues all the time. I gather that Alan Gregg was invited to come initially, in part because your executive director had visited the United States relatively recently and had been appalled by what he saw as a reversion to more primeval social values and attitudes, and the way in which there was a regression on matters of importance and of values which we hold dear in Canada. And therefore, Alan would have come to speak to Canadian values as a juxtaposition to what we're seeing on the other side of the border. And what we are seeing on the other side of the border is obviously worrying to many without me making gratuitous political judgments. But it is true, I think, as someone who spends a great deal of time in the United States, that since 9/11, there has been an atmosphere of suspicion and dread, and there has been an atmosphere which isn't as tolerant, to put it mildly, of civil liberties and the range of minority rights as is true in this country. I was reminded of that, as we are all reminded day in and day out these days, by the intense debate that is taking place in Canada over same-sex marriage. And that, of course, draws on the most intense philosophic, religious, and ethical convictions of large numbers of Canadians, whatever side they may adhere to. But in the United States, sometimes things get a little out of hand. And I recall that just last month, literally just last month in the United States, right-wing groups attacked SpongeBob SquarePants. As you will all know, with an extraordinary force and venom, because SpongeBob SquarePants was seen publicly holding hands with his cartoon sidekick, Patrick. And the group, which is called We Are the Family Foundation, was preparing a video to be circulated amongst the schools. It was then revealed that this group, We Are the Family Foundation, had on its website an appeal to tolerance, including people of differing sexual identity. And this, of course, was a most unseemly mask for the support for gay rights, and many members of the right wing in the United States had traumatic apoplexy. Whatever we're given to in Canada, that is unlikely to happen. Nor in Canada would we be in the situation that PBS was in just last month when they pulled an episode of the children's show Postcards from Buster, PBS, Public Broadcasting System, because one of the episodes of the show showed the evidence of a lesbian couple. And that a major network in the United States should be pummeled into submission, absorb such a venomous and malevolent censorship as to pull a show simply because there was evidence of lesbian parents, is something, again, that speaks to a certain degree of intolerance, which I don't think in this society and community of Canada would be put up with for very long. I smile because we have a lesbian daughter, Ilana, who has two wonderful children, and Michelle and I are familiar with the realm of lesbian parenting, as most may not be, and of course it is as lovely and supportive and delicious and affectionate and thoughtful as all good parenting inevitably is. And the fact that in the United States you can have these detestable spasms of irrationality, then embraced by major establishment groups, is something that is profoundly sad and nerving. Things may from time to time get out of hand in Canada, we know that, but they never get out of hand to that extent. And we are, as a country, sustained in part, and I don't want to encourage a self-indulgent egomaniacal instinct, but we are sustained in part by libraries and librarians. And all my adult life, I have had a tremendous affection for libraries and librarians. I've never understood, for example, how you can possibly have a school without a library. It has been completely... completely and totally beyond me. I can remember making these speeches in the legislature years and years ago. Now, admittedly, on the other side of the legislature was one of the most reputable group of pre-Paleolithic Neanderthals that had ever been assembled. As you can see, I have stilled my political instincts. But these matters were matters of significant debate. And the role of libraries and the way libraries and literature and now all of the technology which has been added, the way these things shape the life of a child is the stuff of life. And every book, every piece of literature is the stuff of revelation for a youngster gradually emerging into the world of curiosity, awe, wonder, and exploration. Back in 1959, I was teaching a course in English to the students of Accra Secondary School in Ghana. I had no credentials as a teacher, but I had gone to the country for a conference and was so enamored with the society that I stayed on and got a teaching job at Accra High School and also at the university. And I loved my students at the high school. They were so excited in the immediate post-independence period about the sudden cornucopia of knowledge, and they were so intensely engaged that every single item on the curriculum was a matter of revelation. And interestingly enough, and this is rather odd all in all, but I wasn't about to challenge it at the time, the school board in Accra had chosen as the Shakespearean text for that particular year Merchant of Venice. And I was teaching Merchant of Venice, a play which has always fascinated and unsettled me in both proportions for reasons this audience will understand. And one of the kids put up her hand and very earnestly looked at me and said, "Mr. Lewis, what is a Jew?" And I thought to myself at that moment in time, how extraordinary to be able to respond to an elemental question without all of the paraphernalia and the apparatus to which it is subject in the rest of the world and by virtue of history, and talk to these youngsters, these deliciously evolving minds, about concepts and ideas and groupings and exploratory thoughts in a way which instilled in them a tremendous excitement for life and their futures. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the exchange which followed. And now I understand, as I grow a little older, the power of the internet and of television and of video, but for me, in the most old-fashioned way possible, I'm still hanging on to books. The problem is, and I thank the organizers for allowing me to make some kind of international excursion in these remarks, that so many, many kids in this world have absolutely no access to reading, to books, to literature, let alone to the more advanced technological refinements. I noticed that in September of last year, in Cape Town, there was the gathering of the International Board of Books for Young People, IBI, for the first time meeting in Africa. And there was a tremendous discussion at that conference with several hundred people of the traditions of African storytelling, of the absence of African literature which embodied that storytelling, of the absence of literature generally which gave a sense of ethnicity and culture and minority concerns and interests, and how the basic and animated exchanges between speakers and audience involved bringing those elements into play, finding a way to produce the literature, finding a way of getting it into the schools, finding a way of using the local languages, vernaculars, and dialects. It was intense and it was meaningful. But the profound problem is that on that continent, as on much of South Asia and Southeast Asia and many, many parts of Latin America, children have no access to libraries, librarians, and literature at all. In fact, I think it's fair to say that children don't have access to a childhood. Now, I have always felt that it doesn't take much to morph the warped views of sexual and other relationships into the moral enigmas which face the world more generally. It isn't a big stretch from the prejudices and bigotries and intolerance in so many parts of society to notice that there is a moral vacuum on a number of serious issues internationally. And that moral vacuum has a tremendous impact on children. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that in the context of literature. Number one, way back in 1990, we passed internationally the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It was ratified immediately thereafter by almost every single country in the world. As a matter of fact, the Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most ratified international human rights covenant that exists. Every single nation on earth has ratified it except two. One is Somalia, because Somalia has no government to engage in ratification. And the other, predictably, is the United States of America, because the United States does not like to ratify international conventions which may eclipse their national law. But every single other country has ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, including the clauses which say that children should have access to the best books and literature and libraries. I mean, there are actually such clauses. Take a look at Article 17 written into the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And nor have countries paid much attention to the protection rights of children which were enshrined in that convention. The kinds of things with which Craig Kielburger has been dealing so heroically for so many years of his young life. So we haven't really addressed child soldiers or child sexual exploitation or child labor or children who are disabled or street children or any of that range of children so profoundly and extraordinarily vulnerable in so many parts of the planet. In northern Uganda today, there continues to exist a lunatic religious sect called the Lord's Resistance Army, which on a regular basis abducts young adolescents from boarding schools and villages, takes them across the border into the Sudan, turns the boys into child soldiers and the girls into sex slaves. There have been up to 30,000 children abducted in the last several years. 10,000 of them are dead, we know that now. 10,000 of them are locked into the Sudan and we can't find them any longer. And 10,000 of them made their way back to reception centers in northern Uganda, where I've spent a good deal of time personally, and you can't imagine how those little lives have been eviscerated emotionally, physically, psychologically. And when you talk to those kids and you ask them what they want, they almost all say to you, "We want to go to school." It's an extraordinary phenomenon. You recall the excitement after the Taliban were defeated in Afghanistan and suddenly there were pictures replete in all of the newspapers and all the television screens of the world of these young little girls going off to school for the first time with such excitement. I can remember when Lloyd Axworthy, our former foreign minister, was visiting Freetown in Sierra Leone after the rebels had moved into the center of the city and amputated the limbs of children in order to strike terror into the hearts of the population. 20,000 amputations in a matter of a month. And Lloyd was standing in a little hospital looking down at a young boy in a bed, the young boy without arms. And Lloyd said to him, "What can I do for you?" And the little boy said, "I want to go to school." Everywhere you turn, that is a deep and indelible yearning in the human soul. And if you attempt to define it with these kids, as please believe me, I have often done, for them it means books. It means books in which they write and books which they read and words which they learn on blackboards. For them, it's the cornucopia of a whole possible future. And the fact that the world has not been able to sanctify that for children, the fact that you can have a terrible civil war going on in northern Uganda for 20 or 30 years, and as has been said recently, the Security Council of the United Nations, everybody failing to pay any attention to it with these appalling consequences for children, it's almost beyond belief.
even now, this may surprise you to know, there are more people in internally displaced camps in northern Uganda than there are in Darfur. There are 1,800,000 people in northern Uganda, virtually the entire population, which has been completely turfed out of its villages, and for safety and security, ends up in refugee camps. And recently, when I was in the little community of Gulu in northern Uganda, I saw something that is very, very hard to convey. They called them the night migrants. The parents are so frightened, even in the refugee camps, that at night they send their children into the center of the community where there are shelters established for them. And at dusk, in a kind of surreal, Dante-esque phenomenon, you see children walking, ages 7, 8, and 9, in single file, down the sides of the dusty roads into Gulu to take shelter for the night. There were 6,000 children in the one shelter which I visited. And you look at those kids and you ask yourself, this is a childhood? All these children want is some kind of security, both in family and institutionally, which will give them a life, and the life is not there. As I tramp around the African continent, I just came back from Zambia, I'm virtually on my way to Angola, I spend a lot of time moving from country to country, and one of the most vexing realities of that continent is the children can't go to school because they can't pay the school fees. See, there never used to be school fees. Will you allow one more brief political eruption? There never were school fees in Africa years and years ago. And then along came the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund at the end of the 1980s and early 1990s with an economic theory called structural adjustment, where they would give significant loans to the African countries, but they imposed certain conditions in return for the loans, and one of those conditions was called user fees. And it meant that the schools had to impose a fee for the attendance and education, and the health sectors, the hospitals, the medical clinics, had to impose a fee in order to provide health coverage. And suddenly, all the education systems in country after country were imposing school fees, and more kids living in their families with less than a dollar a day were unable to attend school. This is particularly grievous and agitating when you think of it in the context of HIV and AIDS, because the kids have lost their parents. They can't pay for the uniforms, and they can't pay for the texts, and they can't pay the school fees. And so they remain out of school. And you speak to these kids and you ask them, what do you want? And they want to go to school. Why do you want to go to school? Because we want to sit with our friends. They have books, they say to me. They have books. They don't mean books as we know books. They mean they have little scribbling pads to make notes in. There are no books in the great majority of schools. None at all. And occasionally there is a reader which is shared by 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 children. I mean, the things we so naturally and immediately take for granted are precluded in the lives of these youngsters who have such an insatiable wish to be like every other youngster of that age. And they're struggling absolutely heroically, but without the response which one would hope would come. It's so odd what we do to children. I was recently in a little project dealing with orphans who are infected with HIV, a large number of orphans who are HIV positive, and many of them are showing signs of full-blown AIDS. And while there is now in Africa a tremendous effort being made to extend treatment to millions of people in order to overcome the carnage of the pandemic, the children are getting completely short shrift, because children always bring up the tag end of the human equation.
And what is so phenomenal about it is that we do not even have pediatric formulations. Can you believe that? We've reached the year 2005, and we don't even have the pills or the syrups in quantities designed for children of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years of age in order to treat them. You have this bizarre phenomenon where doctors and nurses actually break the tablets in half and try to speculate on how much will be needed by the child relative to the child's weight, or have a gradation of syrups of different volumes, again to reflect the child's weight. In all of the responses to the pandemic, which deal with the availability of antiretroviral drugs, we have not yet, to this day as I stand here, fashioned drugs for children. There are over 2 million children infected in this world. There are 700,000 who need treatment today, and we don't have the pediatric formulations. It's an extraordinary commentary on the way in which the world deals with these issues around kids. It's a commentary on the way in which we are struggling to put in place the kind of moral imperatives and moral anchors which will civilize international society. It leads me to another point I wanted to make, which was just last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, that remarkably brilliant economist from Columbia University now, Jeffrey Sachs, tabled what were called the Millennium Development Goals reports. The Millennium Development Goals were agreed upon by the entire world in the year 2000 at the United Nations, which would be achieved, one hopes, by the year 2015. And the goals were entirely predictable. The world got together and said, what do we most need to turn this into an international environment which is tolerable? So they came up with cutting poverty in half, dramatically reducing infant mortality rates, dramatically reducing maternal mortality rates. Do you know that, like some kind of Kafkaesque clockwork, year after year for the last 20 years, we've lost 600,000 women in childbirth every year without ever being able to reduce the number. 600,000 women dying in childbirth in the developing world, and we've never been able to reduce the number. So quite naturally, that became one of the goals for the year 2015, as did putting all children of primary school age into primary school. There are 123 million children of eligible age who are not in school, over 60% of them young girls. An effort to bring in a greater approximation of gender equality, an effort to turn back the pandemic of HIV and AIDS, an effort to have sustainable environments, and finally an effort to get the Western world to deliver the financing which it has forever promised and forever betrayed. And Jeffrey set it out with a tremendous intellectual verve, and everybody celebrated the extent of the analysis. But whether or not the money will ever emerge to make life tolerable for billions of people is as yet a matter of conjecture. I point out, you won't object, that this last week President Bush asked for another $80 billion for Iraq this year. Taken together, Iraq and Afghanistan, we will have spent close to $300 billion by the end of 2005. And we can't find, relatively speaking, a microscopic pittance of that to rescue the human condition. And in a very real sense, that's why libraries and librarians are indispensable to this society. Because you unleash, you make available the ideas which allow for the value judgments which this world must increasingly make. These aren't abstractions. These are people fighting for survival. And the extent to which they understand the choices and the arguments and the inequalities and the absence of social justice and how to correct it. That's part of one's Weltanschauung. That's the way the world has to work, and you make it possible. Never depreciate the one or two or three or 100 minds you open in the course of plying your cultural trade. It has an extraordinary impact, and it should never, never be depreciated. You know, it was 1969 in this country of Canada when Lester Pearson chaired a committee of the Western countries that decided that the target for foreign aid for official development assistance for all of the industrial world should be 0.7, a famous 0.7, 0.7% of gross national product. And not a single member, it's worth noting this, not a single member in the intervening 36 years, not a single member of the G8 has ever approximated 0.7. Not one. Who has? Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Holland, Luxembourg. I'm gradually, as I grow into my dotage, becoming more and more enamored of reincarnation. And when I come back, as I'm now determined to do, because I actually quite enjoyed life, I'm going to come back as a Nordic. Because these Nordics have a sense of social justice that isn't obtained anywhere else on the planet. But all of the countries with the resources who solemnly accepted the 0.7 target and who have reaffirmed that target umpteen times since, most recently at the conference in Monterrey in Mexico in 2002 and the conference on sustainable development in Johannesburg in 2003, they are shameless because they never approximate the amount. And so internationally we raise $50 to $60 billion a year for foreign aid, when if we were to honor the 0.7, we would raise a minimum of $200 billion a year and achieve all of the targets of the Millennium Development Goals, which Jeffrey Sachs set out. And we are so disingenuous. Today, as I stand here, it's probably now over given the time difference, the finance ministers of the G8 met, and one of the things that was on the agenda was the forgiving reduction or cancellation of African debt, because there are so many of those African countries paying more on servicing their debt than they are spending on health and education combined. And you will recall, any of you who watched the news, that yesterday in Trafalgar Square, before a group of 22,000 people, Nelson Mandela, Madiba as he's known to his own people, made a tremendously passionate speech about how inequality and poverty are equal to slavery and apartheid in the annals of world injustice. And he's speaking today to the G8 finance ministers as well. And our finance minister, forgive me for this, but I just can't take it anymore, the way people are dying unnecessarily and everybody trifles with the periphery. Our finance minister, Ralph Goodale, a perfectly lovely fellow, announces just 2 days ago that Canada has decided to engage in the cancellation of African debt and will pay their percentage of what is required to service the debt for the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the Monetary Fund. And then you look at the fine print, and he's paying the servicing of the debt proportionately for Canada, which will represent roughly 4% of the total, he's paying it for 10 years until 2015. There's no cancellation of debt. There's simply an assumption of a small part of the servicing of that debt for 10 years. It's like this irresistible need to engage in smoke and mirrors with vulnerable societies. And we won't get away with it. There are too many strong non-governmental organizations, too many groups of principle who will insist that you've got to be honest in these transactions. Either you're going to cancel the debt, which everybody who has any plausible analysis would agree must now be done, or you're going to pretend to trifle. That is, you'll assume some of the burden of servicing for a while, and then the debt is reinstituted 10 years hence, with all of the servicing relationships. It makes me ashamed, actually, that we would engage in that, because Paul Martin has shown himself to be pretty progressive and pretty concerned
when it comes to international matters. And you will allow me, as I bring these somewhat tendentious remarks to an end, to finish my own observations by talking about the carnage that is being wrecked by the pandemic of AIDS. Because it's impossible now internationally to discuss these issues of human equality, to discuss issues of culture, of literature, of education, without realizing the extraordinary erosion of families, parents, children, communities, as a consequence of the pandemic. And it's not merely Africa, which is admittedly the epicenter. It's China and India and Russia and Ukraine and the Caribbean and large pockets of Latin America. And it's true that in the Western world we have turned this fatal disease into a chronic illness by use of antiretroviral drugs. But in the United States, the prevalence rates are rising amongst the African American communities, particularly the women, and they're rising amongst the Latino communities, and they are rising in the United Kingdom. And there are particular groups in Canada where they are also rising. This is the most horrendous pandemic the world has ever known, has ever dealt with. I've never known how to convey that. But the pervasiveness of death in Africa just breaks the heart. I'm speaking to friends. I just can't get over it. I was completely unprepared for it. I thought I understood because I've been working in Africa for 45 years. But I didn't understand. People go to work in the morning and die in the afternoon. You see a clutch of school children in their vivid uniforms on the side of a street as you drive down the pathways of southern Africa, and you think they're in a schoolyard and they park for a moment and they're in a cemetery. You go into the adult wards of hospitals, male and female. I just did that in Lusaka in Zambia. And there are two or three adults to a bed.